everyone for reading the draft. I know it's rather rough, so I appreciate it. I think the paper can be broken up into sort of three sections. The first one concerns a kind of factual background for this premise that there is an enormous and growing market for watching other people playing video games. And this is kind of strange, but it's actually not. It's sort of a natural evolution of the growth of gaming as an entertainment choice. And just like you have enormous variety in the kinds of video games that get produced, you also have enormous variety in the kinds of secondary content that gets produced based on those video games. And then this is going to be the YouTube, predominantly. And then the second part of the paper is really just a brief legal analysis of how this stuff is infringing, and then if it's infringing, is it subject to some fair use defense? It's a pretty brief discussion, but there is some interesting differences, I think, in the fair use analysis in the video game context as compared to something more traditional like movies or television. And then the last part of the paper is really an EULA discussion, which is sort of concerned with to what extent can you contract away your fair use of software specifically. And this is really part of the larger discussion that we've had before, which asks how people are using IP law and copyright law specifically to protect an interest, a private interest in a product that really isn't in the IP of the product itself. And this is relevant here because, of course, you can't buy software anymore, basically. You can contract someone to write you software, but everything you buy as a consumer is licensed to you. And the traditional argument was, when you're in violation of that license, you're in violation of the copyright permissions in that license. And so then you're violating copyright law when you use the product that you've sort of lawfully purchased. So that's sort of the general overview.
You're violating the license too, right?
Yeah, so potentially you have contract claims and you have claims associated with the permissions in the license. Any questions, concerns, anything? Yeah?
What's the difference if there's going to be problems with... I know there's probably as far as like a mass distribution scale but if you have people at your house watching you play video games, as is often the case if there's only one or two players involved, and then you want to go ahead and record that same gameplay and put it on... on a website for other people's games.
Right.
Is it just the numbers that make the difference, the legal difference? That because you can have a house full of 20 people, but if you put it online, 200 people see it. Let's be honest.
Enormously popular, right?
Yeah.
It's not going to be. Well, I think from the publisher's perspective, the answer to that is probably yes. That having multiple people play the game in a sort of a personal environment is absolutely in their interest. But then having people who haven't purchased the software watch it as an alternative to buying it is potentially an issue for them. Now, almost every license has the clause that says, you can only use this software for personal, non-commercial use. And so then the question becomes, well, is uploading it to YouTube, if you're a partner, you make money via advertising, is that a commercial use? And if it is, do they have the right that to sort of demand that you ask permission before you use it in that way? Because the whole point of fair use is that you don't have permission.
If I read a story, if I read a book to my child,
right,
am I violating copyright? Is that a performance?
I don't think there's a court in the country that would say you are. I'd have to look at the statute.
How about if I'm a volunteer at the library and there are a bunch of 12 kids and I'm reading a book to them? I'm just thinking, assuming the same issue arises in conventional copyright.
Well, so often those kinds of experiences fall under fair use. If it's for some educational purpose, that wouldn't be a commercial activity. But I know the NFL sues people fairly routinely for displaying. I know there was a church a couple years ago that wanted to have a Super Bowl party and sort of broadcast the game on a big screen, and the NFL went after them and it turned into this huge sort of media circus. And eventually the NFL sort of backed off because it was really bad press. But that would be the kind of thing that sort of hardline publishers are interested in protecting or preventing.
There's a few things I think are interesting in that respect. There's a lot of clunky laws, it seems like, or definitions of public gatherings and what constitutes a public gathering. And, you know, this many people are at your house, and that, you know, if this percentage of them are related to you and whatnot. I think that's really, you know, it's hard to tell. One of the other interesting things that I've seen is, you know, whether or not they'll be put into practice, I don't think they will, but there are patents that show the technology in modern gaming consoles like Xbox One and PS4, if they have the camera that's pointed towards the audience, so to speak, and can count how many people are in the room at the same time.
Ah.
If they're watching content through the system, you know, if there's too many people, it sends a warning, like, you know, there's too many people watching this content.
So do we know this exists, or is this only something that some people have speculated about? The reason I ask is, as I may have mentioned, I've got this general rule, mostly in historical context, of being suspicious of any historical account that makes a good enough story to survive on its literary merit. And yours sounds like something which could be true, but equally well, if somebody said, you know, they've got that camera, I bet they could use it for, in 15 minutes it would be packed.
Well, I don't know if they've made them up, but I'm pretty sure I have seen actual drawings that looked like, you know, they were from a patent application.
Uh-huh.
Whether or not someone just created those and it wasn't sort of a hoax type thing.
Could also be they have a patent but never did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I just thought, you know.
No, it's a neat idea.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting aspect too.
Yeah, that sounds like very much a nightmare scenario.
It was like the Terminator gene, which was a real idea but never happened. And I bet half the people in the world think it happened. This was a GMO technology.
There's just other problems with the Terminator gene. It seems like left unchecked, it would just weed itself out of the population like immediately and not cause any other lasting harm.
Mm.
But that's not the subject of today's
conversation. Right, correct. But one of the many things that occurred to me reading your paper goes back to a point I may have made, probably have made here, and that is that a video game that is played only online, for a moment, I'm thinking of World of Warcraft, is technologically protectable in a sense in which most sort of forms of IP aren't. That if I have a movie, if I want to make the movie available to people in any form other than in the theater, and maybe even then, I can't prevent somebody from recording it and then pirating it. But I can, in principle, prevent somebody from doing that in World of Warcraft. And that, in a sense, one might think of the part of World of Warcraft that is exposed by a playthrough as being the equivalent of a novel, and the part that isn't as being the equivalent that isn't. That part of what was intriguing me, in a sense, is, and World of Warcraft is one of these I know most about, that one of the things World of Warcraft is a story. It's a terrible story. That's one of the things I like least about it. But it's a story, and clearly they think it appeals to people. As a story, it really could compete with a playthrough. If you say I don't know how many of you played World of Warcraft, but one of the things some people find irritating is the extent to which they make it too easy as a game in order that people can, as it were, walk through the story. As characters in the story. And one can at least imagine that the farther they go in that direction, the more they really are threatened by someone who says, you don't have to play for World of Warcraft. You want to see this story? Here it is on your screen. And on the other hand, that's also the part which in the long term is hard to protect via copyright because you can't, it's hard to enforce copyright online and you can't technologically protect it. Does it make any sense to sort of distinguish game as game from game as story in terms of what does or doesn't get protected or can't get protected?
Well, I think, I don't know if there's a legal distinction, but I think there's a huge difference in the experience of a game that is predominantly linear and has some ending and tells a very strict narrative, and a game that is an open world experience where it's more difficult to tell a story that's compelling and interesting because you have players doing all sorts of different things out of order at the same time, essentially breaking the story, doing everything they can to break the story. So I think there's a strong argument, at least anecdotally, that if you have a very linear game, like Bioshock Infinite, something that's you sort of experience once, and there are twists in the story, and it's an experience that's much more similar to watching a movie, whether that's a good or bad thing, I don't know, than to something like World of Warcraft, where if you watch someone play through all of Bioshock Infinite, you're receiving a significant part of the experience of playing Bioshock Infinite, and that's less true, I think, for a game like World of Warcraft or other sort of open-world games, where without the sort of input element and the decision-making, you're not getting the full experience.
So suppose you were trying to make an argument, maybe you're suggesting how copyright law ought to be interpreted, and you would like to make an argument within current copyright law for saying that the one kind of work is protected and the other one isn't. How do we do it? I want to say, look, he put up on his web tube all of Bioshock, whatever it is, and the result is that nobody's going to want it. Whereas all he did was put up an equal amount of material, but what was it? It was him showing how to beat a particular boss, how to beat the Thunder King in World of Warcraft.
A particular moment.
And they maybe did a whole bunch of them, but though, putting aside what the law ought to be, you are now the lawyer for him in front of a judge that doesn't like him. How do you explain why they're different things? Under current copyright law, because I think you can do it.
Well, you could maybe argue that
him try first, then you can try.
Is a stricter reproduction. In other words, if the value of the game is in the narrative of the game, you'd have to establish that first. Then by essentially uploading the narrative of the game, you've copied the game in a way that you haven't copied World of Warcraft. Certainly you've copied some small piece of it, but as part of the analysis, if the value is in the story and you upload the story, you've copied the story.
We've got two other people on coming.
I think you're in the right direction, and I don't know if there's a clear answer, but I think it could be covered within the realm of the idea expression dichotomy, in a sense where if you take a super bare bones game that has little story but still might be interesting to watch, I'm kind of thinking of, if you're into it, I'm thinking of like Super Smash Brothers or something like that.
How about chess? We don't have to limit ourselves to video games. Chess has no plot.
Yeah.
It's very interesting for people who like chess.
Yeah, and the interest is sort of based on how it's not so much in the actual representation of the chess. You know, there's different types of chess boards and all sorts of. So it's more the idea of chess. And I think that's the idea side that would be less protectable. Whereas there's games that are so borderline to game and movie. I'm thinking of, there's a game for PlayStation called Heavy Rain.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And Heavy Rain almost has zero aspect of, like, really, you know, controlling your character. You're kind of following this linear path, and then when certain events happen, you have to quickly press a button. And it's almost just like, what story are you going to see? That is such a specific mix of characters and that I think it would be definitely more protectable within that dichotomy.
So what do you tell the judge? How do you explain to the judge why, in terms of existing copyright law, his behavior is not violating World of Warcraft's copyright and his is?
I think World of Warcraft is closer to the middle. I think if we took something like chess...
Chess would be an extreme case, yeah.
Yeah, I would say... I would try to push this, whatever case I was representing, closer to the idea of chess and saying this video representation shouldn't be protectable because the interest that people have on it is based upon the idea and not upon the expression.
And I want to know, where in the Copyright Act does it say that it depends on what the interest is based on? I'm the skeptical judge. All right, you had an answer. Yeah.
To get the strategy right. And maybe if you can make an argument about we're looking for the instructions on how to beat this boss versus I guess that goes back to your question about where interest lies.
Well, you could say that that's either factual. I suppose you can make that argument. You could also say, under fair use, that represents some sort of educational or other.
Yeah.
Our next paper is really about the patent versus copyright tension. But the argument I wanted to get you to make, and I think it's a legitimate argument, is that one of the fair use criteria is how much of the work is copied. So suppose we've got a game which is 90% the same for everybody. In that case, showing one person going through it is just copied 90% of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose we take chess at the other extreme. Every chess game is different, very nearly, unless you're deliberately playing through some old game. So therefore, of all the possible chess games, you have copied 1/1,000,000,000th or something, much less than 1/1,000,000,000th actually, whereas in the game you were describing, you actually copied 50%, 80%. Is that a fair statement that you, in fact, right?
Probably.
So, yes, that's right. And I mean, the thing about World of Warcraft is it could be either. That sort of part of my complaint about Blizzard is they think of it too much. Well, too much of the story, just they have lousy authors either way. But still, if you think about most people playing World of Warcraft, the experience that you have is going to be different from that most other people have, I would think. Now, not all other people. Another person with your character doing the same thing, who has followed the same set of advice and so forth, might be pretty similar, but there are going to be thousands and thousands of those, and you're not going to see thousands of videos. Yeah?
I get your point about within the statutory language, the interests of whoever is watching the video doesn't necessarily matter.
Mm.
I don't really have a good answer, but I'm wondering why is that a problem to you, thinking about it?
If we're thinking what the law ought to be, it isn't a problem. I was just trying, I just thought that one of the interesting, there's a certain sense in which it seems to be all of your papers are really, almost all, are going to deal with two different questions. One of them is, how does the law as it is bear on this set of issues? And one of them is, what ought the law to be with regard to this? And I was just thinking in terms of the law as it is, that it seems to me you could fudge up a couple of not implausible arguments. The next one, of course, would be that one of the criteria for fair use is to what extent it undercuts the revenue stream of the copyright holder. And you could say, well, look, in the case where it's a close substitute, it badly undercuts his revenue. In the case where it's not a substitute at all, it probably enhances his revenue. Now, of course, that gets to another point. Imagine, implausible as it is, that it was really easy to enforce copyright law. Suppose we said that the game owner has an absolute right to, boil you in oil if you put 3 seconds of his game up on YouTube. What would actually happen in that world? What? I don't know if you're right. You're Blizzard. Blizzard's advisors say, oh yeah, one of the reasons people like World of Warcraft is that they can go up on YouTube, watch through an expert play through this boss, learn that, and then show off to their friends how skillful they are. Once if you're convinced of that, what are you as Blizzard going to do?
You might say the best advertising ever.
You're going to say, of course I won't forbid it. I'm just wondering whether this is, I'm not sure if it is, but I'm wondering whether this is a case where the law matters less than it seems to. Because it might be a case where in the situation where you're going to argue they shouldn't enforce the law, it doesn't pay them to enforce the law and therefore they won't. All right. I mean, I've got a bunch of books up on my webpage and, you can download them anytime you like. And that's because I don't think it's in my interest to enforce my copyright on those books, basically.
Well, there's a difference definitely between sort of potentially what's legally enforceable and what makes sense from a business perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important distinction. But there's also a lot of disconnect and miscommunication between those two concepts. And
businesses may be stupid.
Businesses may be stupid, and they make mistakes.
I mean, in a sense, this goes back to the argument about Watt that we read a long time ago, which may or may not be right. But the economist says, well, you can't be right about Watt, because obviously the rational thing to do would have been to license his steam engine and make lots more money, and all the people on the other side say, yeah, but he didn't. So that's one possible answer. Maybe they were just being stupid. Yeah, you were.
I think going back to the part where you were talking about how much of the game is taken, I feel like that's sort of also assuming that the entirety is watching what happens in the game, but in reality, I think the underlying thing here is that a lot of people play games because they sort of want to put themselves to the test and see if they can do this.
Yep.
I mean, yeah. Otherwise, that, you know, if you could see it online, why would you go try and do it yourself anyway?
I feel like at this point in the conversation, we should start and talk about genres, because they just have so much to bear with. Like, I think there's a huge difference between a sandbox-based strategy game. That includes something like Smash Brothers, but it could also include like SimCity, where the fun part is to develop certain strategies. And then there are games like Final Fantasy, S-Series, or Heavy Rain, I guess, where it's really so close, the genre is so closely tied to the plot that it's hard to separate those two. And so those are really drawing off two different standards. And we should categorize some of them so that we can talk about what rules are best with it.
But there, in a sense, it seems to me, is a third category that you're leaving out, and that's the one where what you're enjoying is the story, but it's the story that you're telling,
mm-hmm.
not the story that the author is told. You think
you're the categories that I'm in the sandbox.
Well, that's good. Let me give what seems to me is the biggest example of that is Dungeons and Dragons. All right, Dungeons and Dragons, there's a little bit of a sort of fake world background, but really it's a framework for people to tell their own stories in. And it's an interesting phenomenon, because my guess is that at this point, probably a significant fraction of successful fantasy authors are people who were DMs 10 or 20 years ago, because it really is a case where you're doing the same skill for the fun of it. But that's one which it seems to me it's neither the skill in the game, and that I assume good D&D people aren't really mainly interested in can they best manipulate the rules to kill the monster, nor is it a story written by somebody else. It's a framework for writing your own story. And World of Warcraft is partly that. That World of Warcraft, one of the things I used to be a part of on the server that I was on, was that somebody had put together a defensive alliance. It was basically a bunch of guilds and individuals who were committed to preventing the other faction from trashing our cities. But part of sort of the logic of what it was doing was that we were equally opposed to our faction trashing their cities. That if you sort of think about the modern hawk-dove kind of division, and part of the fun of it, part of the game, at least for some of us who were playing, was being able to say, and one of the things that I remember my character used to do when somebody was trying to, I was on the Alliance side, someone's trying to organize a raid against the Horde, and this was back when the Lich King was the evil guy. And so my character would ask how much the Lich King was paying him to sow dissension between his enemies. And that was fun. All right, so we were, in a sense, making our own story inside inside that. And that really is different from both the gameplay fun and the following their story fun. One of the things that happened at that point was the person who was most responsible for organizing that, who was I think, undergraduate student somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, and at some point he decided that he couldn't afford to keep spending all of his time on World of Warcraft. And so he needed to take a vacation. So he set up with some of the people he'd been fighting against on the other side, a plot line in which his character had been kidnapped and therefore was off scene for whatever it was, 4 months or so, while various people did various things. I ended up writing, having my character, who this particular character only speaks in verse in World of Warcraft. And so he wrote a poem describing an entirely fictional, even inside the story version, of what had really happened in that plot. And so, but my point is only really that there is, it seems to me, at least, there may be more categories we're missing, but there are really, that you're right that there are several quite different genres which sort of blend at the edges. Yeah.
To me, that situation seems to fit in line with almost like a visual representation of fan fiction, because you're using their characters, but you're telling your own story.
So that's right. Fan fiction is, it would be another, I don't know if any, I don't think anyone's doing, I don't remember anybody doing a paper on fan fiction. It would have been fun, because that would be another very interesting area to look at. But yeah, no, that's right. It's got some of that element. Although it's, yeah, well, I guess that's about right, because World of Blizzard is providing the background world you're doing it in, and some of the characters, and then you're doing the rest. Something else that was occurring to me had to do with the question of a performance, and there were a couple of issues that I wondered about, and one of them is, let me put it, what are you performing? This goes back, in a sense, to the same issue. If we have a game where the purpose is to watch it, then you're performing it. If you have a game where the purpose is to play it, then letting people watch it is not performing the game. And I don't think it depends on being online. And one of the other things I was thinking about, does anybody know whether they have real space Star Wars performances in Korea? In Korea, I gather Star Wars is practically the national sport, or so I'm told.
StarCraft.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. StarCraft. I'm sorry. I misspoke. StarCraft. Yeah. And I was wondering how any of this would play out. Suppose we do it in an arena. Suppose we've actually got this big screen up there, and here are the two best players in Korea at their presumably very good gaming machines, and then there are 1,000 people in seats watching. How would the, I don't know what Korean copyright law is, but suppose you did that here. How would that play out in this?
Blizzard would sue you. they're very litigious. I mean, from their perspective, that's clearly a commercial use. That's clearly not personal. And so they're very aggressive about licensing the rights to have even relatively...
So you think what's going on with Blizzard is not that they think it undercuts them, but they think they can make money out of it.
Yeah.
Because I was also thinking about the question of Magic. That Magic the Plague one of the things they do is to run tournaments. In fact, I had a friend who was the person who ran them, I think. They may still work for them, for all I know. And presumably, I don't know, do the people who do... It's Hasbro now, I guess. Does Hasbro object if you want to organize a Magic tournament? Anybody know?
There's a set of sanctioned Magic tournaments, so that there's... if you run a shop, then you can get involved in their sanctioned tournaments, and they happen at regular intervals and have certain requirements and meet certain standards. I have never heard of Wizards trying to shut down somebody who was doing an unsanctioned tournament, but maybe if it was a game shop, it's conceivable.
So what is the sanction? What is being sanctioned by you? Are you getting something like a chess player rating or something?
Yeah, there's...
They have various incentives. Yeah, and there is some sort of ranking, because I know you can qualify to go to large sanctioned tournaments and earn points and all sorts of stuff like that.
But there's a pretty liberal, like, just a Friday night Magic tournament that they run, and any game shop can get in on it, and I think they get perks for running them according to the standards set forth by Wizards of the Coast.
And does Blizzard, does Wizards of the Coast then charge anything for permission, or do they just see it as a way of selling cards?
I don't think they charge. I don't know for sure, but I think that it's more of a promotional thing and kind of a way of maintaining the integrity of their game.
And in the video game context, online, I think that the idea is that they can monetize this by cooperating with, you know, and promoting Major League Gaming and stuff like that. So the people who make, and I'm not really as familiar with this, but League of Legends, like you mentioned before, don't they put on tournaments online that people pay to watch, or at least pay to go to one of those situations where they put it up in... on a big screen and have a bunch of people there watching it?
I don't know.
Yeah, Riot has a number of sanctioned events and then some very large tournaments.
And there are ones where people are watching them in real space.
Yeah, they just had the like season 3 championship or whatever was in LA at the Staples Center.
So pay-per-view, I think.
Yeah, they have pay-per-view, and then they also...
So what games are these?
This is League of Legends.
Which I know nothing about.
Which is, I think, the largest game in the world now.
Huh, what is League of Legends?
If you've heard of Defense of the Ancients or Dota,
you know, Dota from
that was where it kind of stemmed from.
That's
what is it?
Is
it superheroes or something?
And you take the World of Warcraft over-the-top RPG engine, and they give you control of just one character in that, and you're controlling one character who evolves over the course of about a 45-minute game, and it's five guys on either side playing effectively King of the Hill or Capture the Flag. You try and fight your way to the other side amongst the kind of NPCs that just walk stupidly and 10 people controlling.
I see.
Characters.
It's not one that I come across, right?
It's interesting, though, because that whole genre is based on a mod for originally, I think it was a StarCraft mod, and then it became a very successful Warcraft 3 mod and has since spawned sort of an entire subgenre of these.
Well, that would have been another interesting thing that nobody did a paper on, but people looking for papers for some future, for journal articles, would be the whole question of games where people can make their own maps and their own variants on the games. That I know my younger son did a lot of that with StarCraft, playing it as well as, and apparently StarCraft has been modified into everything. You know, it's a Civil War game, it's a World War II game, it's mm-hmm. World War I game, and so forth. And, at which point it's also getting educational, which is also one of the things intriguing about this whole world, in a sense, is the way, is its potentials for being educational for the fun of it in either of two quite different ways, either intentionally or unintentionally. I think, I don't know if I've mentioned to you my ideas for how World of Warcraft could teach you French. Oh, I want Blizzard or somebody to do the following. You have something like World of Warcraft, and when you're a level one character, the NPCs occasionally use French words in context where it's obvious what the word must mean because they're using it. And as you go up, more and more of the conversation becomes French. And you're thus gradually learning your French vocabulary and maybe even your French grammar. I'm not sure if I want to go to the point where you've got to talk to them in French. That may be too hard. That would be sort of, but that kind of model, if you think about it, and a very, very long time ago, I did some computer programs for a price theory textbook that I wrote. They weren't really games, but they were designed to use interacting with the computer to teach an idea. The other half of it, though, is the degree to which games are educational. All right, that my younger son taught himself to type with no intervention at all by us because he wanted to be able to talk to people. He then wanted to know how to spell words because he didn't want the much older kids he was playing with to think he was stupid. And I argued a long time ago in the sort of home unschooling context that when we got the kids Game Boys with Pokemon on them, and they put intellectual time and energy into Pokemon that almost no child has ever put into his schoolwork. That's my, I think, a fair description. And in one sense, it's a waste of time, because it's a fictional world. On the other hand, learning how, when you're dropped into a foreign world, to find your way around it and do stuff in it is a useful intellectual skill. And in that sense, I think you could plausibly argue. And in fact, going back even further, I've argued for a long time that a number of the famous games can be thought of as each a training for a different set of intellectual skills. Any bridge players here? No. Actually, that's an old-fashioned game. Only old people play that. Bridge is training for the game of coordinating without communication. All right. The way bridge works is you may see four people sitting around the table, but there are really only two players in bridge because a partnership is a single player. You have two people who have interests entirely in common. They have the same score. They aren't allowed to talk to each other when the game is going on. So that really the central feature of bridge, aside from all of the details, is how people coordinate to act jointly when they can't talk. And part of bridge, for those who haven't played bridge, the first step of bridge is what's called bidding, in which you're bidding for who gets to control which suit is trump, basically. And under a set of rules, and again, it's really the partnership bidding, but you can't tell me, you're my partner, you can't tell me what cards you have. But we kind of agreed in advance on an elaborate code by which you make a certain bid if you have certain kinds of cards, and that code is designed to signal me enough so that I can put together your information and my information and say, yes, we could make four spades, we can't make five spades, so bid up to four spades, and if they go higher, they have the contract. All right, so it really is a game about that. Chess is a very different kind of game, all right? Chess is really a game about tactics, ultimately, strategy and tactics, that kind of thing. Poker is really a game about bluffing, right? It's a game that, whereas bridge, the critical communication issues between the two partners, poker is the other way around. The critical communication issue is how you keep the other players from correctly deducing the information you've got. So there's a certain sense in which all of those games really are educational, each in a different set of intellectual skills. And I'm sort of intrigued by the degree to which the games that your generation is playing, some of which I play, but which a lot of other people don't, the same thing is true, it's just different ones, if that makes any sense. Okay. Yep? Yeah? You were going to say something?
I was going to say, have you heard of Little Big Planet?
What?
It's a video game, and the whole purpose is that you can build your own world. And, like, you... I mean... That sounds like the gaming companies are actually allowing people to kind of build their own world. It's kind of like Mario, the old Mario's, except you can build like where you want anything.
But when you build the world, are other people then playing it, or is it all just you?
Other people play it, I think. I haven't really fully played it.
Yeah. Also, I presume that being a law student at least somewhat reduces the amount of time available for such activities.
Also, I'm a girl, so I didn't grow up like playing. Like the guys that play with are so much more skilled than.
Yeah. Yeah, I have this problem with the younger generation too.
But I thought that was interesting because you can actually the games are actually encouraging like other people to think of like new ways of adding to the game, you know, and. I don't know, it's kind of like the opposite problem that we're talking about. Right? Mm. I mean, in that sense, like, is there, like, protection? And is there some sort of protection there still in terms of...
But actually, that suggests an interesting issue, which is really going beyond your paper, we might as well talk about it anyway. Suppose I do a StarCraft map. Can I copyright it?
No, so in the license agreement... It will say, I'm sure, I don't know who publishes Little Big Planet, but I know in Blizzard, you know, they retain ownership over all of the, your ideas they wouldn't own.
Yes.
But all the resources that you use, I don't know if you can insert your own resources into the StarCraft.
Wouldn't they just call it derivative work?
They might. I mean, they don't even have to go that far, because in the license it just says, and we own everything you ever make, basically. but I don't know, something like Minecraft is maybe different from that. I haven't looked at their end-user license agreement. But that would be a company that I would expect might take a lighter approach. Because, again, it's in their interest as a business to allow people to sort of be as creative as possible.
I'll just add that, you know, it'd be a shame if there's a day where Leroy Jenkins is sitting in prison because he... It's those republications or the portrayals of them, whether it be in like South Park and their World of Warcraft episode, or those, you know, funny YouTube videos of, you know, Leroy Jenkins screwing up everything. That gets me interested in the game. I never really, I mean, I played Warcraft before, but never World of Warcraft. I played StarCraft online and in the campaign modes, but it was by seeing other people's involved and, you know, not people in my immediate surrounding or my private life, but seeing other people's enjoyment of it that really made me want to play Blizzard.
Right.
Yeah. Of course, one of the other features of some of these games, actually, which is just talking about your genres again, is the social aspect. That my impression is that I wouldn't be surprised if a majority of all of my daughter's friends are people she met in World of Warcraft. Because she's rather shy, she was homeschooled, so she wasn't, you know, she was in a unconventional, very small school, and then was homeschooled, but she's interacting with all these people out in the world. One of the reasons she ended up majoring in Italian, ultimately, is that she had World of Warcraft friends who were French-Canadian, and were fluent in English. And she thought that if other people were going to learn her language, she should learn somebody else's language. So before she went to college, she came to Santa Clara, which had a summer program for high school age kids, and took a quarter of Italian. And because she was homeschooled, she then took two more quarters of Italian, also because her father was a professor, and so I don't think it cost us anything, as I remember. And that sort of started her interest in Italian. And that's, so there's a whole lot of stuff, where they, I mean, if you think about one of the things from the standpoint of doing this course, if you want to say something interesting that hasn't been said 1,000 times before, one way is to ask what's new in the world and how does IP theory apply to that. And clearly, I'm just looking at the reaction that you will hear, for an awful lot of you, games actually are a significant part of the real world, even though that'll seem weird to most people my age, I would say. Now, some of that, of course, goes way back. My sister's husband is one of the world's best bridge players. And it seems a little odd to me that that really smart people put the amount of thought and energy that the top bridge players put into it, and yet they do, obviously. In a way, that's an interesting question. Let me take this division. It's going way out of your thing. It was an interesting issue. How many people are to some extent bothered by people putting very large amounts of resources, and I'm thinking mainly of human resources, into what could reasonably be described as frivolous activities. If you are told so-and-so has an IQ that puts him in the top 1,000th of the population, and most of his time and energy goes into playing chess, do you regard that as in some sense disturbing or encouraging or somewhere in between? Any feeling? Yeah?
Are you using IQ as a proxy of intelligence?
I'm using IQ as a measure of the ability to do a substantial range of intellectually difficult things. So I am assuming what I suspect is correct, that somebody who could be a world-class chess player could probably be also world-class at what we would commonly think of as productive activities. Not all productive activities, but maybe you could be a world-class computer programmer.
The same guy could be a successful politician, businessman, engineer.
That probably not. That is the... Yeah, that is... I'm not arguing everything, but the question... It just seems to me that we have this intuitive... Think about the term productive. There's sort of an intuition about productive labor and unproductive labor, which goes way back, and it's not clear if one can give a very sharp definition of it. And at one level, it seems to me odd that really able people would put all of their time and energy, most of their time and energy, into games. All right, I see it with regard to my hobby of medieval historical recreation, too, that there are people who are really able people. And what's the important thing about them? It's, you know, running medieval tournaments, and which was not doing it for money. They're doing it for other participants. And I sort of have this mixed feeling, you know, given all that ability, they could be making themselves a good living and contributing to things that value other people. And is there something wrong with the fact that they don't? But let me go back to my chess player, because that's probably the clearest example that you believe that someone who you know is a world-class chess player could have the ability in which he would put the same time and energy, he would have done something productive in an ordinary sense, like writing better computer programs or writing novels for that matter. Does it bother you? Yes or no? Anybody? Yeah?
It kind of does, because I feel like my assertion with productivity is the ability to make other people's lives better. And chess kind of only appeals to really hardcore chess players. Whereas if you're going to do some writing novel that could affect how people live their lives, that doesn't matter.
You were raising your hand?
Maybe, I don't know. Sometimes I feel that way myself. Not that I'm saying that I would be world class to anything in particular.
But all of this is an issue. Absolutely, it's an issue for yourself.
I think that it's like ingrained in my head that if I say like watch a lot of TV one day, I'll feel like unproductive and just
right.
Feel bad about it, and just feel like there is some potential that I sort of lost.
Yeah, no, I think many of us have this sort of tension ourselves, and you know, there's the argument all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy or whatever. But the term I like to use is lotus eating, which comes out of I think Homer originally, but that I think of if I'm spending all my time doing things which ultimately produce nothing. After a while, I start saying I'm eating too much lotus. You know, I ought to be working on a book or something. Yeah.
I think it just depends on where the because sometimes people just value happiness, and playing chess is that much more valuable to them than. I mean, are we looking at society as a whole, or are we looking at the person?
There's an idea in some Larry Niven stories for what he calls a wirehead. And in this fiction, it is possible to insert a wire into the pleasure center of your brain, and then a trickle of electricity, which costs practically nothing, and you're in ecstasy. And sometimes people die that way because it's too much trouble to go get anything to eat or drink. But it's really the extreme version of the way a lot of people feel about things like heroin and cocaine and such. And I think it sort of dramatizes that tension between the idea. In a way, it's almost the philosophical difference between pleasure and happiness, which don't feel like quite the same thing somehow. But anyway, it's a long digression. I just think these are sort of interesting things that people ought to be thinking about because they're relevant to my life, certainly, how much of my time and energy I'm willing to spend to research 10th century recipes, which I'm doing partly because I think it's actually worth doing and some of them taste good and such, but also partly as part of a very large game with a bunch of other people are implicitly playing. But then you could argue that, you know, researching Icelandic law is in the same category. I'm not sure. One other question that occurred to me is one reason why the owner might object to your playthrough is that it's subverting the game as story. But it might also be subverting the game as puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
All right, suppose we say the reason you play it is to be able to face this puzzle. Now, the answer could be, if that's true, then nobody's going to watch it, because they wanted this puzzle. But what if part of what's going on with the puzzle is it surely is going on in something like World of Warcraft is status? If you say, look, I beat this boss, and not only did it, I did it at the heroic level. You know, I'm a big guy. Well, how did you do it? Well, I went up on YouTube, and someone who really was clever showed me how to do it. So that you could argue that there's an element there where the ability to cheat, as it were, in a certain sense, undercuts the value of the game. That once everybody's doing that, now you don't get the same kind of status and ego boost from having beaten that boss. Well, we know how you figured out how to do it. Makes sense? Doesn't make sense? Yeah, maybe.
Unless you're the first group to do it.
Yes.
It still exists to a certain extent.
That clearly is status, the first group on your server, even though it doesn't have to be on you. I guess it has to be really the first group in the world, because the other servers can put up on the YouTube how they did it.
Right.
Yes.
I feel like that's actually happening already. So when you go back to chess, there are a lot of chess books out there. I didn't have the patience to read those, and at one point I just wanted to figure out chess on my own. So I actually figured out a lot of the basic strategies and principles. Got as far as I could, and then I kind of started talking to my other friends who ran from the books and so forth. In that sense, you know, I felt like other people could got to a skill that's equal or higher than mine, but you know, I have this kind of pride where like I figured out on my own.
I understand.
And so that kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah.
Where, you know, why not have? What couldn't a player just refrain from looking it up? And then later on, you know,
yeah. I actually went through that in World of Warcraft, that for quite a while I tried to avoid going up on the web. It wasn't really on how to beat bosses, it was more on how to discover facts, because it seemed to me. And eventually I gave in and decided, well, you know, I have to spend a whole bunch of time finding out, you know, how to do such and such, and I can ask other people online, maybe that's more appropriate, but I also sometimes looked on, you know, did a Google search to find out, you know, where is the quartermaster for that particular faction or whatever. I had a couple of other notes that I was going to... Oh, yes. One of them is, can we argue, if we go back to the case where he's been putting up YouTubes of World of Warcraft, he's going to say, well, you know, one of the criteria for fair use is educational. And I was teaching them how to kill the Thunder King, and that's surely educational. Is that going to work? It's going to fly.
Well, the other consideration, though, is the amount of substantiality of the portion used. So he could potentially explain how to do it, use screenshots of the steps, and avoid using, you know, 20 minutes of footage from the actual game. Maybe it would be less effective.
But it wouldn't really reveal much less, because the footage, the still picture is still showing the scene, it's still showing what's happening. The only main difference is what the players are doing, and that's what Blizzard doesn't own, really.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
If people are coming to the YouTube video purposely, and I'm assuming they are because, you know, it's not being shoved in front of their face,
yes,
otherwise, can we assume that they don't really care about the game as puzzle anyway?
Maybe, but that's why I was suggesting that you might argue that even if you don't care about the game as puzzle, your ability to cheat on the puzzle reduces my fun who does care about it. Because one of the reasons I care about it is I want to prove to people how clever I was, because I was able to solve it, and I can't prove that anymore because they'll just assume I did it the way you did.
Yeah,
maybe not as strong an argument, but it did seem to be some element of an argument there.
Yeah, it also seems more relevant in situations where you're sparring with other players as opposed to just, you know, going
That's
through
true.
A one-player game.
A single-player experience would be different in that respect.
Yes. Another sort of minor question that I had reading your paper. Is the beta test a publication?
If you sign something that says this is not a publication, or if you agree to a, you know, a license that says this is not a publication, then it's probably not. I'd have to look. I don't know how courts have dealt with that issue.
What about I'm curious because I don't actually know what defines a publication. Suppose I write up something in to be circulated within my company,
mm-hmm.
and it's circulated to 1,000 people, all of whom agree to keep it secret, essentially. That count is not published?
I believe, yeah, that wouldn't be a publication.
Yeah. So the essence of a publication is what?
A distribution to a public audience, I would say. So I mean, courts have held that even limited, if you could send out 3 copies of something. If those people weren't members of your organization, that could constitute a publication. But if you're inside an organization and you have, 12,000 employees, that still might not be a publication. If it's clear that what you're distributing is meant to be kept secret.
I think even then that can be a publication. If you give one magazine and then photocopy it and give it to every one of your employees, you're going to end up copyright.
That would be infringing. But if it was your content, if it was your material, if you sent an email to your company,
sure.
That wouldn't be a publication.
Yeah. I guess the one last point, which I think I mentioned before, I was trying to think about a little bit more, which has to do with the question of what it is to perform a work. And the analogy I was thinking, which isn't a very good one, is I don't violate Apple's patents if I show a picture of an iPhone. Even though the iPhone's got the patented ideas built into it, as it were. And I'm wondering if there's a sense in which, if you think of the purpose of the game as playing it, that then the essential thing happening is not happening for everybody except me if you're watching me play. Maybe something along those lines could be used.
There's an interesting thing, I think, associated with sort of full playthroughs and this sort of uploaders to YouTube who do Let's Plays and other sort of they create communities around their personality and their attitudes, and the success of their channel has very little to do with the games they're actually playing.
Mm-hmm.
The people aren't watching for the game. They're watching this player and his attitude and his jokes or whatever appeals to that micro audience. He might be horrible at the game, and that might be the appeal of the player. It's not necessarily that the game itself is driving the viewership. I think it's really the personality of the broadcaster.
I was also wondering, I have one other question about commercial use. Suppose I'm not making any money out of the videos that I'm showing, but I am making money selling services which we will suppose don't violate copyright law. So suppose, for example, I'm a trainer. In fact, do those exist in any of these games? I wonder if, suppose there was somebody who said, look, I'm really good at playing a fire mage in World of Warcraft. And for $10 an hour, because, people work cheap at things they enjoy, I will teach you to be a top-level player. Does that profession exist yet?
If there is a small market for that. I know in League of Legends that existed at one point, where professional players. I know it existed in StarCraft as well.
Well, it exists in Bridge. That is, the form in Bridge is people, I don't know how people know about the Bridge world, but Bridge, unlike chess, there is a rating system which is cumulative. That is, chess is an equilibrium rating system. The way the chess rating works is that if you beat a player at your rating goes up and his rating goes down. And if you beat a player who's a little below your rating goes up only a little bit and his goes down only a little bit, and so forth. So it's an equilibrium system measuring how good you are. Bridge, I think they've got to distinguish between different kinds of points, but the basic master point system is just the more tournaments you play in, the more you accumulate master points and thus can tell your friends I'm a master or a life master or whatever it is. And there is a real market, has been for a long time, where good players pay very good players to be their partners. So you have paid partnerships. And if you're a top player, I gather you can make significant amounts of money. I don't, as far as I know, I don't think that my brother-in-law has ever done that. He's also a professor at UC. I'm forgetting, but one of the UCs, a computer science professor as well as a bridge player. But I think there are people in his league, as it were, who make their living. And you don't do it with somebody who's rich and is no good, because you're never going to win a tournament. But somebody who is rich and is good, but not really top good, pays the expenses of both people and may pay additional money to his partner. And part of that is in effect to buy status. Although how much, I don't know, because only the really good people know that that's what's going on. And part of it is to buy training, because, you know, it's a partnership game, and you're playing with a partner who's a top player, and you're getting better and better. But so there's a little bit of that happening here. So suppose that I'm in that business, and the reason I put up YouTubes of me beating bosses, no advertisements at all, but I'm building my reputation, and then I'm charging $10 an hour for my training. Is that a commercial use of the videos?
It's a good question. I'd say it's a commercial use of the game, whether it's a commercial use of the video.
Well, but the training, I think, is a commercial use that's legal. So I can't see. Maybe I'm wrong. I haven't read through the Blizzard.
I think as long as you're not exchanging some virtual item in the process.
Sure. So suppose all I do is we set up our computer so you can see my screen.
Right.
You own a copy, I own a copy, we're both paying our subscription fees, and you watch me do stuff while I explain it, and then I watch you do stuff and say, well, look, you should have done this instead of that. You can sort of imagine, it probably happens, you can imagine that kind of coaching happens. I don't think that violates any of their rights, and the question is the fact that I'm being able to do it because I'm putting up YouTubes of my things count as a commercial use? There ought to be some non-game equivalent of that I haven't thought of.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. My inclination is the publisher would probably call that commercial use. If you're making money from it, they would probably qualify that as commercial use.
It's basically just advertising.
Yeah. You're essentially, you're benefiting from the publication of their copyright work.
All right. If no one has more questions, we've got a second one, which probably won't get finished today, but we can at least get started today. Anybody have anything more for this? I thought it was an interesting subject.
Thank you, guys.
One of the reasons I teach courses like this. You want to do the next one?
Yes. I have a question, too. Upon further research, I've moved this further towards board games.
All right.
And I didn't know if you had a section of board games you were planning on doing later.
Do this. I'll have to look. I don't think it is. If there is, maybe I'll put it in for the next class.
So my thesis is no longer the same as what you all read in my paper. But it's all still in there, and I'm happy to discuss or defend anything that I put in there, although I may not.
So tell us about your new thesis.
So my new thesis is more in line with board game mechanics. And upon further research, it turns out that a combination of copyright and trademark law actually creates a really interesting and flexible monopoly protection for board games that only exists because of the specific nature of how that business runs. And so patents, in fact, I think my original thesis was that patents were the right way to go. And although game mechanics fit into what can be protected by patents appropriately, I think covering them with strong patent protection would undermine and destroy the development of a lot of these board games. So I'm going to have to explain all this, since you did not actually read this, because I haven't written it yet.
Well, if you have written it in the next couple of days, we will put up a revised version, and we can discuss some of that next week.
Could very well be possible.
See if you get it done. But now talk about what you've got to talk
about.
Sure
thing. So anyways, the thing about these board games is very, very few of them are successful. The ones that are successful are the blockbusters that run for generations and produce an incredible amount of income. These things are Monopoly, the big games that you've all heard of, Clue. More recently, Days of Wonder came out with Ticket to Ride. Has anybody played Ticket to Ride yet? That's the new big one, selling 250,000 copies each year, which is huge. A successful game in the board game industry sells 20,000 copies and costs about $20,000 to design and produce. So,
how much does Settlers of Catan sell?
Settlers of Catan is another one of those blockbusters.
Because it just seems to me there's a sort of a genre of what I think of as German games that all the people who went to Harvey Mudd and worked at Google were playing at least 10 years ago.
There's also the award, the Spiel something German.
Spiel.
Yeah, Spiel something.
And games that win that award get a huge boost in notoriety, which I'm going to use to bring back to. Board games have a threshold of accessibility that they need to surpass before people are willing to expend energy and effort to buy the game. So even though you can maybe create, Monopoly has a patch on their board, but it's ran out long ago, you can create a game that plays exactly like Monopoly, people won't be interested and willing to go out and buy it because they won't know that that's the game that they've played before, that's the game they already have invested the time in learning how to play. So this threshold of accessibility that's maintained by Monopoly's copyrights and trademarks is used to maintain kind of a pseudo-monopoly against infringers who would not be able to compete. And to further enforce this is some large economies of scale. Once you have notoriety and people like your game, it spreads from there. People say, hey, come over, play my Monopoly game. It's really great. And you play Monopoly, and now you know how to play Monopoly. Maybe you go out and get it. And then further bringing this all back in,
there's also an economy due to the fact that the more popular the game is, the more likely it is that your friends know how to play it.
Yes, yes, and that's another, it's another threshold. You have to not only have one person who knows how to play, you have to have three or four in most cases, or maybe even more, depending on the game. So the popular games can maintain their popularity without a strict patent legal protection, just because those are the games that people know and those are the games that people want to play. Another aspect of this is board games are predominantly sold during the holiday season. If you look at a chart of when board games are sold, it spikes in mid-November and crashes in January every year. These are grandmothers, these are parents buying games for their children, and they're not the players, they're not the hardcore market for it. So what they buy are the games that they know, have played, and have had past experience with. This is why the blockbusters are the ones that last forever into perpetuity and creating money, and the majority of games that are just as good. The quality of some of the smaller produced games are just as good, but they don't catch the notoriety, they don't get the self advertising effect of that. And this effect, this monopoly is sufficiently protected by copyright and trademarks. If the rules aren't exactly the same and you have to put the effort in to write a new set of rules, there's no guarantee that your set of rules will be as accessible. And if the rules aren't as accessible, then they don't sufficiently enable people to play your game compared to the game that they originally learned.
To what extent is this effect undercut by going back to my discussion of genres? I'm thinking about things like railroad games. Mm-hmm. And I haven't played them very much, but my impression is that there's a family of games made by different producers, all of which are basically similar, and that the people who are enthusiasts for them are not enthusiasts for a particular one, or even for a particular family. You've got a case where the same game exists for British and American railroads, but rather for railroad games. So does that mean that in that world, if you come out with a somewhat better, more interesting version of the same basic idea, that you can free ride on the popularity of existing games?
I'm not sure about the railroad games, but
war games would be another example. But Avalon Hill more or less invented the genre back when I was 10 or something, maybe a little younger, earlier than that. And to what extent at this point, if there are particular firms which have got a family of games with the same rules on different wars, but to what extent is there sort of a community of war gamers such that if you come out with a new Civil War, take Civil War, because that would be a particular game, if you come out with a new Civil War game, will people who are playing whatever the current popular Civil War games all hear about it? And
it's possible, but that group of people are not the people that create the blockbusters, the real money makers. That's the group of people that will buy the $20,000 run, the 20,000 copy run, which will be considered success.
Yes.
With the larger group of people, anybody
of total revenue from games, how much of it is coming from games that are selling, say, less than 40,000 copies, and how much from games and more? Do you know?
I don't know offhand, but I'm sure it's a small fraction. The vast majority of it comes from the games that sell consistently generation after generation that you find in Targets and the Walmarts, not the games that you find in the Legends store at Valco.
I bet if you went to Targets, they're going to have a wider range than that, but I may be wrong.
They have been expanding. The board games are becoming more popular, but it's still driven by the mass market
yeah.
consumers.
Be worth if you can, seeing if you can actually find numbers, because you're probably right, but on the other hand, there's the problem that if there are 100 small games and 5 big games, the big games look much bigger, but the sum total might not be bigger.
It's my intuition that that's not the case from what I've read so far, but I would... That would be a good question.
The case of the thing I would like to do with games is if you ask people what are the major industries in the U.S., they get it wrong. That is to say, what are the major... I'm using industry broadly. What are the major lines of business in the U.S. measured by total employees, say, what would you guess? People think of things like auto or steel because those are big firms. But, of course, the restaurant and bar industry, I think, employs more people than auto plus steels plus probably computer as well. But it's a whole lot of small firms, and therefore isn't visible in the same way. And so there might be a problem there. I don't know if there is, though.
Yeah. It could be. I could check it.
Yeah.
But like I've been saying, I think that if you are somebody producing a game and you're somebody who's creating a game for the purposes of creating money and you need the incentive to make the game, what you want to be is the big blockbuster. You don't want to be the little guy who barely breaks even. The profit margins are very small because you have to pay along the way to produce an actual physical object of this game that may or may not produce anything, succeed at all, even if your game mechanics.
So how different is computer? I'm just thinking that one of the differences between computer games and physical games, one of the reasons that my younger son, one of whose hobbies is inventing board games, I encouraged him that he ought to be looking at computer programming to do them that form, is that the marginal cost is zero for a computer game.
Right.
Does that result in a noticeably different world there?
Oh, absolutely. Even board games that are ported into computers, into these apps, which is really a growing industry of, and maybe a way of advertising, those games sell for $4, at most $10 for an app, where the physical game would be $40. And those are driven by bulk sales of these cheaply, easily produced items. The contrast, though, is all the cost for programming those games is up front, whereas you can produce smaller runs of a board game to test the water and see how it goes.
Well, except that a lot of the cost of the board game is all the playtesting and not the physical production.
It's a smaller fraction of the cost.
And, of course, once we've got the 3D printing that we've just been talking about, making the physical game would be much easier.
Yeah, that might actually be another topic for another day, is how 3D printing is going to affect
the game industry.
Board game copyright.
Yeah, so we have a friend in Boston who's got a 3D, I think by now he's got a 3D printer, and we've made some suggestions that maybe when my son wants to actually do one of his games beyond cards, he could get the pieces made that way.
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be huge.
Continue, though, with what you were.
Yes.
I was distracting you.
No, I could also at this point open up to questions, but I want to do one quick run through because I do have the Tetris in my paper, the idea of the court case where the judge found that the four blocks were part of Tetris was part of the feel of the game, the expression as opposed to the idea, when really that seems like a misinterpretation. The game of Tetris is played with these limited shapes and how they connect, and playing the game with different shapes, 5 pieces, it changes the whole dynamic of the game. So that's also on the board if anybody wants to talk about that.
Could you argue that that just seems a fair problem?
You could. The only way you could play Tetris game is with those particular pieces. I see that being a valid argument. Yeah, absolutely.
That's what occurred to me when I was reading your piece, that it seemed the obvious defense yes, it is part of the idea. Yes, it's part of the expression, but it's the only way of expressing that idea.
Yeah.
Other people? None of you were going to jump on him?
I do have an interesting thought as well in the board game context. There's some amount of fungibility in the mass market, the people who are just buying a few games, the less extreme gamers, where if there's one game that looks like Risk and another game that might play better but is also looks just like Risk, like 1940, whatever the other fighting board game is, they'll buy Risk because they know that one, or Risk because of this pseudo-monopoly that I believe exists, raises its price really far. Maybe they'll buy the other one because they only need one of the type.
Do we know how many games people are buying for people other than themselves?
That's
what your evidence on the timing suggests.
Yes, that's a big chunk of what people buy during Christmas as gifts.
I was thinking about the terms of the game. So let's get really, yes, this is really small. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But whereas the same
some people games, might argue, but yeah. Some people might argue, but yeah, compared to a lot of other games, that's a short learning curve.
Right. I mean,
which game is this?
Risk.
Ah, yeah.
But I was thinking some of my sons could have, like, I think my first tried to teach me it, but then it just took so long that it was like, so late that I shouldn't have been so I'm wondering, but I'm wondering about the impact of how willing it is, how easy it is to cross that threshold from a game, because you're talking about there's certain thresholds that you want a game to have accessibility and accessibility to more people. You have a game that is fairly accessible from a different perspective. You can do the transition from how many there are. So we're seeing a lot of this, but I'm wondering how that would be.
Well, I think part of what you're saying actually illustrates the accessibility problem with games. The rules of Risk are no more complicated than the rules of Settlers of Catan. But when did you first play your first game of Risk? Like, when you were a child, you started getting introduced to it? It's Risk is one of the games that's been around forever and has had this effect of people understanding it, having already crossed the threshold of understanding that game. And as such, when people are looking for games, it's more easy for you to access Risk than it was for Catan, because you had to put forth that much more effort to learn a new game in that case.
Yeah, I agree with him, though. I think Catan really is a harder game to learn.
I'm not sure about that, but possibly. Yeah. Oh, maybe it's one of those easier to learn, harder to master kind of things, because I've played a lot of Risk, and it doesn't stay easy.
Well, diplomacy, of course, is trivial to learn and hard to master.
Yeah, that's true.
That's sort of the classic example of that.
Yeah.
So this is a problem, you think? Like,
no, I think this is great. Yeah, I think the fact that...
Like, if everyone knows Monopoly, everyone's nostalgic for Monopoly, we all love Monopoly, that's why I buy Monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't that just Monopoly meeting the demand of people? I mean, the fact that I'm now missing out on a game that is maybe by some objective measurement, a better game, or you know, a more complex, intelligent game. I mean, I guess that's a downside.
Except that Settlers was new at one point. That sort of one of the things I'm curious about is sort of the cycle by which the new blockbusters come in.
Yeah.
I'm a little reminded there's a book about computer programs called, I'm not forgetting what it's called, but it's the authors are basically arguing against the network externality theory of computer programs, which says once you've got the dominant program, you're in forever because everybody wants to be consistent. And that's not what happens. But if you really look at what happens, you usually have a serial monopoly. At a given instant, there is a word processor that everybody uses. But if at some point a new word processor comes out and all the reviews say this is much better, 6 months later, everybody's using that one instead. And I'm wondering whether there's some kind of a sort of a sequential monopoly effect of here, where every once in a while a game which is like Monopoly but somehow better in some interesting way comes in, or alternatively, if the new ones are all things like Magic, where it really is a different kind of game that comes in.
Well, they're not all like Magic. There are some of them that really... Magic is one of the more interesting and new games. Well, not new so much anymore. But take Ticket to Ride, for example. Ticket to Ride will probably last generations. It's ramping up to look like it's going to continue to sell as well as...
Is it a railroad game? Or?
It is a railroad game. It's a popular, accessible one. I didn't know that it was part of a set of railroad games. It seems to be...
Yeah. So that's a case where it was not a new idea, at least. I don't know the game, so it maybe had some new features, but somehow became... So do you have any guess as to why one thing becomes a blockbuster?
It's some combination of the game mechanics, the threshold issue, the game has to play well and be fun, and then some combination of how the game feels and how it's marketed, how it gets out, maybe some amount of luck as well. And then once it crosses the threshold, it is self-perpetuating, it becomes self-aggrandizing, it becomes greater and greater because of the fact that it is already well-known and it doesn't have to advertise itself. And people are ready to play it. They already have crossed the accessibility of it.
I think we've roughly used up our time for this time, but I think we ought to continue this on Tuesday. And if you can get a revised version, I'll put it up on the web.
I would like to.